everyone. I'm your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. Thanks for listening, and please remember to subscribe for free on your favorite platform. My guest today is Dr. Hope Erdozian. She is a double board certified internal medicine, preventive medicine, and public health physician, author of the book Phoenix Zones, Where Strength is Born and Resilience Lives, and co-founder and president of Phoenix Zones Initiative. She was named a Humanitarian of the Year in the American College of Physicians in 2017. Her work across six continents has included the development of medical, public health, and educational resources for non-governmental organizations, national governments, and intergovernmental organizations. Over two decades, she has cared for individuals who have experienced displacement and violence while also working on policy to address structural inequities and human, animal, and environmental exploitation. Hope received her MD from the University of Oklahoma College of Medicine and holds a master's degree in public health from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She served as faculty at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences and Georgetown University School of Medicine, and she now serves as a professor at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. Welcome, Hope.
Hi, Andrea. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Your work doesn't just merely discuss the challenges and problems out there, but truly envisions a world where we help and lift others up and create actual positive change. And what's interesting about that is that it's not because you've lived a sheltered existence and are unaware of the harms that occurred. As a human rights physician, for example, you've seen enormous suffering. Yet your work reflects what I would describe as pragmatic optimism and the ability to see real-world answers to serious challenges. In your book's introduction, you talk about growing up on a small farm in Oklahoma, knowing early on that you wanted to become a doctor, and then having your eyes open to a variety of things in college and medical school that eventually led you to straddling the fields of medicine, public health, and ethics. Can you walk us through that evolution?
As you mentioned, I grew up on a small farm in Oklahoma, and I learned pretty early about human rights violations around the world, in part through my parents and my dad's history as an immigrant to the United States. You know, like a lot of kids who grew up around animals, I also was concerned about animal suffering in addition to human suffering. Fast forward a little bit later on, in college, I studied human rights violations like war, war crimes, genocide, torture, and continued to be interested in animal suffering as I was learning more about human suffering in the world. And by the time I got to medical school, I started to think more clearly about the connections between human and animal suffering and the treatment of people and animals in society. Later, as a physician, I've been able to work in human rights, in animal protection, in medicine, in public health, and ethics. And over that time, I've worked with a lot of really fantastic individuals and organizations who are tackling really difficult issues. And a lot of that work is siloed. So over time, I also started to think about how that siloed work is critically important, and I continue to do that siloed work with others, but how important it is for us to think about the nexus between the treatment of people, animals, and our shared environments. And that's what ultimately led me to where I am today and to writing the book Phoenix Zones and to co-founding a global nonprofit organization called Phoenix Zones Initiative.
I read your book when it came out a couple of years ago, and I think that's when I first got in touch with you, telling you how much I loved it, because it really does straddle what you were describing, the interconnectedness of things. I want to talk about the first chapter of your book, because it opens with the stories of a girl named Ayana, a dog named Love, a man named Doc, and a woman named Grace that collectively led to the conception of the book and eventually the founding of your nonprofit. Can you tell us about them and also how their stories help set you on the path where you wanted to understand the links between violence against a variety of different vulnerable populations?
Yeah, so I won't do their stories justice, but just briefly, Ayana was a girl who was forced into marriage with an older man, and she was rescued from that fate by a police officer. And Love was a dog who my colleagues and I found during a trip to Kenya for some human rights work that we were doing. And Love had a broken wire around his neck, had been hit by a car, was laying in a median in between two roads, and had bruises and lacerations all over his body and was in shock. And so we stopped to help him in whatever way we could. Doc is a man, a physician, who I met during during the course of my human rights work documenting evidence of torture in asylum seekers coming to the United States and seeking asylum. And Grace also was an asylum seeker who I met while doing that work. Doc had suffered. He was imprisoned in Iran after he had spoken out for his colleagues that were being persecuted. And Grace was a woman who fled her home country after she experienced severe sexual violence. And what I came to realize over time is that all four of them shared something, and that was their vulnerability to suffering, their vulnerabilities. We're all vulnerable. We're all vulnerable beings. Biologically, we are vulnerable. We can all become wounded. But there are other forces that make us more vulnerable than others. And so social, economic, legal, political forces that trickle down in the form of what the late physician Paul Farmer called structural violence. And ultimately, those forces were raining down on Ayana, on Love, on Doc, and on Grace. The other thing that we have in common that all four of them also had in common is that they also had the tremendous capacity for strength and resilience. They were given the opportunity. And in the book, Phoenix Zones, I write about how just like structural violence can trickle down, so can structural resilience. So we can make our social, economic, legal, and political norms and frameworks such that they don't cause suffering, but instead contribute to individual and societal strength and resilience. Thinking about the commonalities across individuals of different nationalities, of different ethnicities, of different genders, and even different species, that's really what formed the basis for the book.
In your work, you mention what's called the Phoenix effect in medicine, namely the transformation of despair into hope. And you illustrate that with some examples, almost like a physical and emotional rebirth. And you also describe what you call Phoenix zones, the literal or figurative sanctuaries that embody the core principles of liberty, sovereignty, compassion, justice, opportunity, and dignity for every human and non-human animal, noting that practicing these principles can encourage resilience and broader social change. Can you share some examples of each of these principles?
The easiest way to talk about those principles, which often appear rather abstract to us, is to think about Doc and Grace and Love and Ayana. And liberty is what Doc experienced when he was freed from prison and ultimately when he was granted asylum in the United States. Sovereignty is what Grace experienced when she was free from sexual violence, even though she lived with the medical and psychological consequences of that violence. Dignity and opportunity are what Ayana experienced when she was rescued by the police officer who stepped in and saw her for who she was and for her self-determined potential. And then I hope compassion is what Love felt when we tried to step in for him and help him.
If I remember the story right, Love's last moments were enveloped in love by you and others around him at the time. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we picked him up and we took him to a veterinarian. I mentioned he was in shock. I imagine that was a hemodynamic shock because of bleeding and other factors. And we met a veterinarian who was kind enough to meet us at his clinic with his assistant. And we really tried to envelop him with as much love as we could. You know, you look back on those situations and you always think, could I have done something differently? Could I have done better? And I think we all learn from those circumstances. At the time, I think we did the best that we could, and we certainly led with love and compassion for him.
That is really what matters when we look back. It's certainly what came through to me when I read his story in your book. Phoenix Zones Initiative, your nonprofit, is on all the major platforms. And in addition to the actual content you post, you also use a lot of positive hashtags that speak to people's better nature and the need to recognize our connection with others. And some of the hashtags are global community, global well-being, interconnectedness, compassionate living, universal compassion, compassion for all. Tell us what they mean to you.
I think all of those hashtags, all of those phrases represent the importance of being morally consistent in our application of compassion. You know, we are all intertwined. All of our lives are intertwined, and we see how that manifests every day, you know, whether it's in climate change and how that affects our daily lives, whether it's in violence and conflict and how that affects us now or in the future, and also even in disease risk, we see that we're all connected in one way or another. And so those problems are all bound up together, but so are the solutions. And I think one of the only ways we're going to solve a lot of the great challenges that are before us is to expand our circles of compassion so that we are compassionate without bias, without prejudice. Truth is, compassion is contagious. In both people and animals, there's a release of oxytocin with compassionate and caring behaviors. And it feels good to care for others and be compassionate toward others. And that's one of the reasons we're inclined to do more of it once we do a little bit of it. And others are inclined to do more of it whenever they feel a little bit of it. So, you know, I really think that there's a good case for more compassion and justice in the world.
Your website, phoenixzonesinitiative.org, provides a wonderful resource of effective advocacy, a toolkit for supporting advocates working for systems change. I highly recommend everybody listening to it. Check it out. In the toolkit, you define effective advocacy as that which addresses the deep roots of social and environmental injustice in ways that transform our systems and institutions so that everyone can rise and thrive. Why is getting at the root cause of problems important, rather than simply focusing on helping others with their immediate needs in the here and now?
You know, I think both are important. So we have to address the here and now, the suffering that's before us. We have to see it for what it is and respond and intervene anytime we can. But we also have to address the roots of suffering, of the problems that we face every day and that we share. And I kind of liken it to the prevention and response to fires. You know, we certainly need fire departments. We need fire departments in all communities, but we also need social norms and laws and policies that prevent fires from occurring in the first place, because otherwise we're just going to burn everything down. And if you ask any firefighter how they feel about fighting the overwhelming number of fires that we have today, they're exhausted and it's just not sustainable. You know, we have to prevent problems before they occur. We have to get at the roots of the problems that are before us. And, you know, there's a lot of heavy lifting involved in prevention and addressing the roots of problems. The benefits of doing that heavy lifting are just inexplicable.
Going back to the toolkit, you also talk about key principles that make up Phoenix Zones and lay them out in a type of pyramid form. And in some ways, that reminded me of psychologist Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, with the most fundamental needs at the bottom and then moving upwards until you reach the self-actualization level. The Phoenix Zones principles start at the bottom with respect for liberty and sovereignty, then compassion and tolerance, then justice, followed by opportunity, and at the very top, dignity. Why did you choose that particular order?
In the book, I talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, with deficiency needs being at toward the bottom of the pyramid, and what are referred to as self-actualization needs at the top of the pyramid. And what we found over time is that all of the needs that he described, which overlap quite a bit with the principles, as I try to describe in the book, all of those needs matter to our physical and emotional well-being. And over time, scientists have found that it may not be that one set of needs is necessarily more important than the other. It may be that all of them are important. So that was a convenient way for us to represent them. And, you know, I struggled a lot with the order in which to present the principles in the book. And we struggled with the same for the toolkit. But over time, it seems that what's really true is that these principles really overlap more than anything. And together, they help determine whether or not we can be healthy and well. We don't just need freedoms from abuse and exploitation, freedoms from threats to our liberty and sovereignty. We also need freedoms to opportunity. We need the hope that opportunity brings us. Thinking about these issues and learning more about the science has helped me to rethink how we do present those principles, because all of them are critically important to our health and well-being, to the health and well-being of other beings that we share this planet with.
Your work connects the well-being of people, animals, and the planet. Can you explain the interdependence among these three and why you believe addressing the well-being of one without the other is insufficient?
So we often refer to this relationship as the nexus between human, animal, and planetary rights, health, and well-being. We see it manifest in a number of different ways. One area is in violence and conflict. Another area is in disease risk. Another area is in climate change and environmental threats that we face today. So in the area of violence and conflict, for example, it turns out that animal cruelty can actually be a red flag for child abuse and intimate partner violence. So on an interpersonal level, violence against people and animals is connected. But we also see those connections at the community and societal level. Amy Fitzgerald is a sociologist who has studied the connection between the treatment of animals and violent crime rates in communities. And she and her colleagues showed that across counties in the United States, the location of slaughterhouses actually correlated with violent crime rates in those communities. And then from a societal perspective, Jim Mason and Charles Patterson and other historians have shown how the historical domestication and exploitation of animals actually became a model for human subjugation, even atrocities like enslavement of other human beings and genocide and other human rights violations that we see all over the world today still. So, you know, that's one area. Violence and conflict clearly illustrates the connections between the treatment of people, animals, and our shared environments. Another area is in disease risk. You know, we've seen with the COVID pandemic that animal exploitation and the exploitation of their environments, their homes, can also lead to the emergence and reemergence of infectious diseases. So industrial animal farming, the trade of live animals, and even the use of animals in research can actually increase the risk for emerging and reemerging zoonotic diseases, animal-borne diseases. We also see that as animal product consumption rises across the world, we're seeing an increase in heart disease and cancer, two of the biggest killers now in America, and increasingly across the globe. Finally, in terms of the connections that we see in terms of climate change and environmental degradation, we know that animal exploitation contributes to greenhouse gas emissions, which obviously contributes to climate change and the floods and the hurricanes, the severity of the floods and the hurricanes and fires that we're seeing today. And then animal exploitation also leads to air, water, and soil pollution, especially through industrial animal farming. We often talk about this nexus, but not only in terms of the problems that have been created by our treatment of our fellow human and non-human beings and the environments that we all share, the ecosystems that we share, but there are also connections to be found in the solutions. If we are going to address violence and conflict, for example, that affects human beings around the world, we also have to address violence against animals. And if we are going to address the risk for disease in human beings, we have to reshape our world so that we are not exploiting animals in the ways that we are, and therefore are able to reduce disease risk, infectious diseases, and chronic non-communicable diseases like heart disease and cancer, for example. And so the list of connections really goes on and on and on. And we work with our partners to address those connections and to identify solutions that lead to a better planet for us and the other beings who share this planet with us.
The term natural rights is often used in human rights discourse. How does Phoenix Zone's initiative expand this concept to include both humans and non-human animals?
So when we talk about rights at Phoenix Zone's initiative, we're basically talking about life-sustaining needs that human and non-human beings need to be well and to thrive. And what we see when we look at principles that we articulate as rights, like the right to liberty, the right to sovereignty, the right to dignity and opportunity, what we see is that they are actually biological needs. And I go into how they are biological needs from a scientific perspective in the book. When we don't have access to those needs, to those rights, we can become unwell physically and mentally. And the same is true for other animals. So the recognition of those rights in social, economic, legal, and political frameworks and norms is absolutely critical if we want to create a society that is healthy and well and has individuals in it, human and non-human, who are healthy and well. And I actually think that the fact that those principles that we articulate often as rights, the fact that they are reflected in our modern and ancient philosophical and religious texts, that is really because they are biological needs that are recognized as critical to individual health and wellness and resilience.
Before we move on, I want to remind all our listeners out there to subscribe to the podcast so you can continue enjoying hearing from wonderful guests like Dr. Hope Vardosian. And now to the next part, which is something that Phoenix Zone's initiative in collaboration with other experts created, and that's the Just One Health Framework and the Just One Health Impact Assessment Tool. I know it would be impossible to go into all of the details, but can you give us a broad overview of what the tool does and how it works?
So people might be familiar with One Health, which basically recognizes the interdependent health and well-being of people, animals, and our shared environments and ecosystems. And we've emphasized the importance of a Just One Health approach that recognizes the connections between health and justice, rights, health and justice for people and animals. With the Just One Health Impact Assessment Tool, when we did our research in this area, what we found was that there's a real lack of economic metrics and tools that address the interdependent health and well-being of people, animals, and the planet, and especially tools and metrics that go beyond GDP, gross domestic product, which often ends up commodifying people and animals and our environments. And so in working with economic experts and other professionals, we developed the Just One Health Impact Assessment Tool that members of communities, policymakers, advocates, and others can use to determine the potential or real impact of policies and practices on people, animals, and our shared environments. And what it really does is operationalizes many of the principles that we've talked about today. And so it's free, it's on the website, and people are free to use it and apply it to whatever projects they either have in mind or that they have in place and would like to evaluate.
And I was also really excited to hear that Phoenix Zone's initiative recently entered into a partnership with the George Washington University Law School Animal Legal Education Initiative to establish a National Commission on Research Ethics, and that the work will mirror that of the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research, which produced the Belmont Report in 1979. The Belmont Report, as some may know, advanced key human research protections through ethical principles that emphasize respect for freedom, justice, and the Hippocratic notion of first do no harm. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, we're absolutely excited to enter into this partnership with GW Law and my co-lead on the project, Dean Kathy Hessler. And the project really is meant to mirror the work of the National Commission for the Protection of Human Subjects of Biomedical and Behavioral Research, which was established in the 1970s by the U.S. Congress in response to public outrage about human research atrocities that largely stemmed from racism, sexism, and ableism, really unethical research practices that were coming to light during and before that time. And so that National Commission, by the end of its 5 years of its appointment, produced the Belmont Report, which emphasizes respect for autonomy or agency, beneficence, this idea that we should do good, non-maleficence, this idea that we should avoid harm, and justice, the idea that we should be fair. And that really set the stage for applications like informed consent, special protections when we can't obtain informed consent from certain individuals or populations, the application of surrogate decision makers in certain circumstances, the idea that we should have risk-benefit analyses and risk thresholds that we don't exceed for individuals who do and don't provide informed consent, and special protections for vulnerable individuals individuals and populations, such as children and incarcerated individuals. And what we're doing with the National Commission on Research Ethics with GW Law is we have created and launched a commission that will re-look at those principles and re-evaluate those principles in today's more than human world, in the research context, but also thinking about broader implications. For example, in thinking about non-human animals, how are they vulnerable in many of the ways that children are vulnerable? Can they ever provide consent? If so, how? How would we assess that? And also in thinking about risk thresholds, there are certain things that children absolutely cannot be exposed to during the course of research. Should we have similar restrictions for non-human animals in thinking about decisions about their use in research? So we're really excited about that project, and the results of the work of the commission will be shared with policymakers, public, members of the media, and professionals across the sciences, medicine, and law and other fields.
What's your timeline on that?
It's a years-long timeline, and right now the commission is working on about a two-year framework to reevaluate those principles that were set forth in the Belmont Report as they apply to decisions about the use of animals in research, but also looking at them again in terms of their applications today for vulnerable human populations still, especially with emerging technologies and kind of where we are in thinking about justice for our fellow human beings and our fellow non-human beings. So more to come.
That's fantastic. I'm already looking forward to following up with you when the findings are out. That's going to be great. And you also use the term more than human world. I absolutely love that. I wrote it down. I took a note and I'm going to start using that from now on because I think it really beautifully encapsulates reality. We are not the only one that exists out there. So more than human world reflects reality and the ethic of how we should move forward in life. Phoenix Zone's initiative obviously believes in building bridges between traditionally siloed movements. Can you share with us some examples of successful collaborations that have emerged from this approach?
Yeah, in almost all of our work, we collaborate with others, other individuals and other organizations. We do that by partnering with other folks in medicine and public health, ethics, human rights, animal protection, environmental protection, conservation. And there are a few examples I can share. One is that we work to affect the implementation of the sustainable development goals that fall under the UN mandate, the United Nations mandate. In all of our work there, both with the NGO major group and with other coalitions, we work to ensure that the rights, health, and well-being are incorporated in the implementation of the sustainable development goals. We would like to make sure that the rights, health, and well-being of people, animals, and our shared environments are incorporated in the SDG implementation. And then another area where we collaborate with a lot of different organizations in a lot of different areas is our work on the World Health Organization negotiated pandemic prevention and response treaty that's under negotiation right now. There, we've worked to influence the legal text of the treaty. We've also led an open letter to Dr. Tedros of the World Health Organization and other world leaders about the need for a just one health approach. We've also continued to work with our partners to influence negotiations surrounding the treaty. And then finally, another area that we work with our partners, our international partners on, is to address the root causes of climate change and environmental degradation, including but not limited to industrial animal farming and its contribution to climate change and environmental degradation. We're part of a coalition to influence a UN Environment Assembly resolution on the nexus between human, animal, and environmental well-being. It focuses not only on climate change, but other forms of environmental degradation.
Phoenix Zone's initiative is working on systemic change, but until that happens, there are those who will still be caught in challenging and sometimes, frankly, horrific circumstances. How can we, both as individuals and society as a whole, be more responsive to individuals who have experienced various forms of trauma?
That's a great question, and I struggle with it a lot. I take some lessons from medicine. In medicine, we focus on trauma-informed care, this idea that many of our patients and their families and communities might have been affected by different sorts of trauma throughout their lives. And to meet them where they're at and to respond effectively, it's important for us to practice trauma-informed care that really draws on the principles that we've talked about. So for example, respect for bodily sovereignty, compassion, and justice. All of those principles make a difference in the delivery of care to individuals who have experienced trauma. And so I kind of try to think about how we can expand that to our interaction with each other, all of which we encounter on a daily basis.
You've also talked quite honestly in your work about how hard it can be for helpers and observers and others to see suffering, and that there's an increased risk of secondary traumatic stress or vicarious traumatization. I came across a moving quote of yours where you said that there is a cost to genuinely caring for others, but there is also an inexplicable emotional gift. Caring for others can make us more hopeful and courageous, and that through the eyes of survivors, we can glimpse the promise of a better world. How can those of us who are in helping professions or who otherwise bear witness walk that fine line between being fully present and at the same time ensuring we aren't emotionally injured in the process?
In medicine, and I think in other fields where there's a lot of caregiving, we talk a lot about the risk for vicarious trauma or compassion fatigue. What I've become interested in is how we can encourage vicarious resilience and compassion satisfaction. And so just like we can absorb the trauma of the individuals who we care for, we can also absorb their strength and resilience through our empathy. And that can make us stronger and more resilient, in part because in many ways, survivors show us how to work toward and live in a better world. And so that hope, I think, is contagious in the same way that compassion can be contagious. Honestly, that's what I've taken from so many of the survivors who I've met over the years. And that's what led me to think about ideas like the Phoenix effect and how we can create more Phoenix zones so that we can all be healthier and well and thrive in whatever bodies we live in.
So contagious compassion.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Phoenix Zones Initiative works on reimagining the social, economic, and legal norms. And I would love to hear from you. What does a world that embodies these reimagined norms look like? What would it feel like?
In almost all of our work, we focus on the creation of an expansion of social, economic, and legal and political frameworks and norms so that they are more inclusive, not only thinking about our fellow human beings and making sure that they are inclusive there, but also in thinking about how they are inclusive of other than human beings in our more than human world. And so our work, for example, focuses on influencing policies, also local policies and practices, national legislation, and also providing resources like the Effective Advocacy Toolkit or the Just One Health Impact Assessment Tool so that others can do the same. But we've also started to think about what we can do to scale our work. And one of the things that we think is probably necessary is more education, more knowledge and skills to be shared with emerging generations and emerging generations of leaders. And so one of the things we're just at the beginning of building is an institute for universal rights, health, and justice that would basically offer classes, workshops, conferences, publications, leadership training, fellowships for individuals who are interested in solving many of the problems that we're similarly focused on solving. And so we're really excited about that. Like I said, we're just at the beginning. But when I think about a world in which we have more inclusive frameworks, I think about that structural resilience that we talked about earlier, this idea that we should have norms and policies that trickle down, not in terms of suffering, but in terms of building strength and resilience for individuals, for communities, and broader society that we all share.
How can people get in touch with you if they're interested in learning more about your work?
Well, we're all over social media. And you can also find us on our website, phoenixzonesinitiative.org. org, and you can connect to our social media channel through the website. And then you can also find me on hopefordosian.com, and I'm also on different social media networks.
Hope, thank you so very much for having taken the time today.
Thank you so much for having me.